Hello and welcome to The Deal Room, where every week we talk specifically about all things corporate finance, from the biggest M&A and PE deals to the strategy that drives business decision making. We aim to bring what you learn in the classroom to life with real world examples, and hopefully at the same time have some fun with it. So let's dive in. Before we begin today's show, I have a really quick favor to ask, and it's only going to take you less than 60 seconds to complete. If you haven't already done so, it would be amazing if you could rate the podcast, or better still, leave a review on whatever podcast platform you listen on. That small action really does make a big difference in helping more people find the show, and hopefully we can continue to educate and make finance interesting and easy to understand for everyone. So thank you. Welcome back to The Deal Room. And last week, the American global investment company KKR held its first investor day in 3 years, laying out a plan to scale its core businesses as it aims to reach at least 1 trillion of assets under management in 5 years. So in this episode, as usual, I am joined by our Director of Corporate Finance, Stephen Barnett, and we are going to take a look at why KKR is the original OG when it comes to alternative investing. From its inception in the past, in the 1970s, we're going to look at the history, come to the present day business, and then talk about how exactly is this firm intending to grow at such a rapid rate in the years to come. So, Stephen, how are you? And KKR history, here we go.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this one. And I just want to do a very quick shout out before kicking off with this deep dive. Last week, I was at Morgan Stanley's offices, and one of their spring week interns ran up to me at the end, said, Stephen, look at my Spotify. And it's just Deal Room followed by Market Maker followed by Deal Room. I didn't catch your name, but I'm so glad that there's at least one person out there that listens to us and that listens to every single episode. He said that he preferred the Deal Room, though. So, you know.
Well, that was because he was participating in a banking session, I'm sure.
And I asked him very specifically, which one did you prefer? Yeah. But anyway, he said it was a fantastic resource for his spring week. So just another little plug to keep getting this podcast out to your friends and maybe even your family as well.
Cool. So yeah, KKR then. So I know a lot of people in finance are very aware of who they are, but if you're entering finance, you might not have even heard of them before.
Yeah, so KKR, much like the other big private equity names, so well known, infamous in finance circles, but are barely known outside of the world of finance. You think anyone on the street would know who Barclays is and what HSBC is and things like that. But you ask them what KKR does and you get a lot of very blank stares. But since we're on the Deal Room, KKR is one of the most influential and interesting case studies. And obviously, as you said, Ant, we're going to talk about the past, a little bit of history. We're going to talk about the present, where they are now. And as you said, their race to $1 trillion of assets under management, the future, and how they're going to get there. So let's start way back when. So post-World War II, private equity wasn't really a thing. And the concept of a leveraged buyout, where you buy as a fund, as an investor, you buy an entire company using debt, became the kind of watchword and the standard operating procedure of private equity into the 70s and 80s. There was no such thing as private equity, and there was no such thing as a leveraged buyout. I've looked at a few sources that claim the first ever private equity leveraged buyout. And I think the one that keeps popping up is McLean Industries as the first ever private equity, so investing or buying out a private company with debt. So McLean Industries bought Pan Atlantic Steamship Company in January 1955 and Waterman Steamship Corporation in May 1955. Under the terms of the transactions, McLean borrowed $42 million and raised $7 million of equity. So $42 million of debt, $7 million of equity. When the deal closed, $20 million of the cash and assets of Waterman was used to repay or retire $20 million of the debt, And there was an immediate $25 million dividend to McLean Industries. So that is moving money around if ever I've seen it. Basically shifting debt into equity into the pockets of McLean Industries. This was really a cottage industry in the 50s and into the 60s. And it was only in the 70s where the asset class started to burgeon. And it really started with KKR. So KKR stands for Kohlberg, Kravitz and Roberts. And these three, actually, it was Kravitz and Roberts who were best mates, first cousins, working at Bear Stearns, were investing on behalf of Bear Stearns in very illiquid private companies and actually doing a couple of non-leveraged buyouts, i.e. buying a whole American company, trying to improve it, and then selling it. Bear Stearns didn't want to turn this into a fully fledged arm of the business. So Kravitz and Roberts, with their mentor Kohlberg, went out on their own with $120,000 and set up KKR in 1976. Discussing their culture and values. This was on the KKR website, by the way. I don't know why this is important, but they discussed their culture and values in 1976 over dinner at Joe and Rose restaurant in New York City. You ever been to Joe and Rose restaurant, Ant?
Well, yeah, we did have a quick look. I think it probably predates even my existence.
Yeah, we found a New York Times article from 1978. Saying it's the next hot thing. So I wouldn't go looking for it in New York. But anyway, I don't know why they put that little vignette on their website, but that's where they discuss the kind of founding principles of KKR. Remember, this is a whole new asset class, private equity. We talk about it all the time on the podcast, but back in 1976, almost 50 years ago, it was nothing. This is a new industry or a new part of the industry. So kind of fast forward, companies created 1976, the original private equity firm. By 1982, they had managed to get their first state pension funds. So when you get a pension fund, in this case, Oregon, Washington, and Michigan Investment, when you get a pension fund to invest in you, that's kind of a bit of a stamp of legitimacy. Pension funds have got very, very strict restrictions on what they can and can't invest in. So getting into the pension fund river of money is a really, really good thing. And they did so relatively early on. They completed their first, what they called leverage buyout in 1984. And in 1985, and I know you've just watched the film of this, so here we go. In 1985, they were embroiled in the RJR Nabisco merger and then buyout, which subsequently became the basis of the book Barbarians at the Gate. And I know how you prefer to watch films instead of reading books, and you took a little look on YouTube. What were your thoughts? Good acting.
Well, I was just looking frantically here because there was the one bit I so happened to land on. You were talking there about debt and the kind of evolution then of like this concept of using debt being a new thing at their founding. So in the film there's this quote, and it's the CEO of that company and Henry Kravitz are having a conversation over a cigar in like a lounge. And Henry Kravitz goes, they're talking about debt. So he raises the concept. He says, debt can be an asset. Debt tightens a company. And the CEO responds. So Ross Johnson says, it also does wonders for your sphincter too.
What an accent as well, Ann. You're practicing that one. Yes, I think it's the answer to that quote.
Because the whole point here is he's pushing back that he's raising this idea of, look, debt will cut jobs. And the guy's like, we're not cutting my staff. I'm not taking on like the risk. I'm not having a heart attack. I want a good life.
Well, absolutely. And this guy, Ross Johnson, really did want a good life. So a little bit of background, and please do, I don't know whether you should watch the film. I think Ant will be appearing in the stage version of the film later on this year, or read the book. It's definitely a must read. So RJR Nabisco was originally the merger of a tobacco company, RJR, and a food company, Nabisco. RJR merged with Nabisco to kind of soften its brand because in the 80s, you know, there was a lot of negative press about tobacco and that stock was going south. So the merged entity, RJR Nabisco, was led by CEO Ross Johnson, who seemed to be a bit of a freewheeling guy. His kind of modus operandi was to get the board on his side and then massively increase management compensation, pile on the perks. I think his compensation tripled. They had 24 country club memberships as part of the corporate perks, 10 private planes. You know, so he, you don't want private equity coming in and sniffing around when you're when you're enjoying the good life, right? However, the stock was in the doldrums. So I think it merged and the share price was at $70. It really, really went down to the low 40s. And basically, Ross Johnson put the company up for sale. Said, look, $40 a share, the market's not valuing the company as it should be. And this was just at the height of the leveraged buyout frenzy. The leveraged buyout frenzy, increasing number of firms realizing they could just pile on debt after debt after debt. Junk bonds were a thing. So Michael Milken's junk bonds and Drexel and all of these different financial innovations contributed to effectively a bidding war between Ross Johnson and his team and KKR. Now, KKR were the credible party in this because I think Ross Johnson just wanted to kind of continue to extract pleasure out of the organization. And KKR were maybe considered to be the sober party who ended up winning the deal at $109 a share, bearing in mind that it was trading at 40. They saddled the company, KKR saddled the company with $25 billion of debt, which represented 87% of the total financing of the deal. Now, this sounds staggering. Pumping a company full of that much debt is a recipe for disaster. As soon as you have a bad quarter, well, you can't pay the interest on your debt and you have to declare default or you have to restructure at even worse terms. And it's just going to set a company up for failure. I read this amazing stat about private equity in the 80s. So in the 80s, 11% of private equity owned companies went bust because of the debt model, 87%. You know, that's so much debt that a lot of companies are not going to be able to service it. So this whole RJR Nabisco experience, and by the way, RJR Nabisco got kind of chopped and changed and spun off and none of the value really got realized, but it was a real high point in the kind of heady days of leverage and made people really question what these corporate raiders were doing. You know, were they just extracting profits and saddling a piece of company with debt, squeezing profit, letting the company go bankrupt? Or did they actually have, to your fantastic quote earlier on, did they actually have, you know, debt sharpens the mind. Maybe it's good to have a little bit of debt to make you a leaner, more efficient company. So very, very good case study for anyone interested in this space.
So for career advice and career prep, then you can watch, so you can watch this if you want to go into kind of the PE world. You can watch Wall Street if you want to become a hedge fund manager. And you can watch Trading Places if you want to become a trader, basically.
Yeah, you missed out on Margin Call. That's a classic.
So that's another one, good one for.
We won't even get started on the Wolf of Wall Street. I think if you want to be a penny stock.
If you want to work in sales, monster. Let's say.
Yeah, if you like sales, maybe go for that. So yeah, you know, load up Netflix and get going. But anyway, so sobriety enters the world of private equity, and as it does with KKR, we go into the 90s and KKR expands into Europe. In the noughties, early noughties, it expands into credit, which becomes an ever increasing, so this is lending money for private equity buyouts, an ever more lucrative and important part of KKR's business. 2005, they get into Asia. Again, it's become a key growth driver for KKR. 2008, they launched an ESG platform, definitely riding on that post-financial crisis wave. 2009, they launched an infrastructure fund. And again, these are going to be critical for their growth drivers over the next 10 years. And then in 2010, they listed on the New York Stock Exchange at $9.70 a share. it's now pushing $100 a share. And that takes us roughly up to the present day.
Yeah, there's a interesting slide that I saw in their Investor Day pack that they put out. And we'll put that in the show note links if anyone wants to have a look at it. It's a bit of a beast. I think it was 302 pages long, but for a little quick glance, there was one that stood out, which was, you mentioned up to their activities and developments up to 2010. And there was like the bar of how they were generating like revenue in 2010. And it was just predominantly PE. It was like still 75% or so volume. And then you see where they are today. And it's so diversified. It's incredible. Like that, how quickly that change has happened. It's insane.
It's unbelievable. I'm looking at that slide at the moment. It says 2010 revenue came from private equity, North America, Europe, and Asia, and then credit, leverage credit. Today, there's about 45 bullet points, everything from global impact, customized portfolio solutions, climate, Crescent Energies, opportunities funds, real estate investment trusts, etc., etc. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It's exploded in the last 14 years and become really significant as part of the global kind of financial ecosystem.
Yeah. And to put some rough context, that in 2010, PE represented, I saw around 75%. It's now only about 20% of that kind of portfolio kind of mix. So couple round of questions then. First Ooh. Pop quiz here.
Here we go.
For you and everyone listening. So what should we go with first? Let's go with assets under management. So you've kind of said at the top of the show, it's a trillion they're gunning for. So they themselves at the moment are at 553 billion as of the end of last year, I think it was. So they do sit within top five.
Okay.
So first question is, who's the biggest and what's their AUM? And then who follows after?
Look, I know that Blackstone are the biggest.
Yeah.
$1 trillion, have they just hit a trillion? I
think it was June last year they hit a trillion.
So KKR following very quickly in its footsteps. Now, I'm pretty confident about, well, two more of those. I don't know what the fifth one is. So Apollo is absolutely huge. I'd say that's bigger than KKR.
What do you reckon then? So Blackstone's 1 trillion, KKR's 550.
Yeah, Apollo 700, something like that.
650.
600. Ooh, there you go. Carlyle is definitely one.
Yep.
Although it's been struggling a little bit more recently. So that's, that would be 500, something like that.
426.
All right. And this is where I'm going to struggle because I'm pretty confident in those top four. TVC?
No. Begins with an A.
Oh, dear. Go on. Put me out of my misery.
Ares Capital.
Ares. What are they on?
378. So they're not far off Carlyle Group.
They're not far off Carlyle. So there you go. And this is, very interesting. Again, $1 trillion is a lot of money. I was just looking at the assets under management for BlackRock. So they're upwards of 10 trillion. So we always have to put, it's a massive, massive slice of global assets under management, private equity, but still relatively small compared to the listed equity, bond funds, etc.
Would someone like BlackRock then have a distinct advantage given its size and breadth and just brain power and technology to be able to compete in a way that in the same space as these other players? Or is it because you're going after unique skill sets when you go to these particular alternative investment companies?
It's a really tricky one. I think there are pros and cons to both sides. And obviously BlackRock's making a massive move into infrastructure. Mm. Just bought Global Infrastructure Partners for $10+ billion. And they are not an insignificant player in the world of alternative investment asset management. To one extent, yes. Having a full service solution, as BlackRock does, so that you can go to BlackRock for all of your diverse portfolio requirements is a fantastic thing. And you know, with BlackRock, you're going to get quality, or at least, to a greater or lesser extent, you're going to get quality. But these alternative asset managers are big enough and their distribution capabilities are strong enough that they don't really miss out from not having the kind of breadth BlackRock does. And there's a lot of statistics, there's a lot of analysis around performance across top quartile PE firms versus second and third and fourth quartile PE firms. And the top quartile well outperform the S&P, and they well outperform their peers. So there is still that kind of, I'd still say with a KKR fund or a Blackstone fund or an Apollo fund, there's definitely a kind of, I want to get in. There's limited opportunity to get in to this new fund that's getting started because these guys are the best at what they do. So yeah, pros and cons of both.
Okay, so next question then is, of those five, so Blackstone is the biggest AUM, Ares Capital is the smallest. In terms of share price percentage year to date, who do you think out of the five has gained the most and who's lost the most?
This is really tricky. This is really tricky. I know that KKR is up 20-25% this year. I only did research on KKR.
so you're right. KKR is up, I think, as of yesterday, 21%.
Okay.
Four of the five are positive this year. There's only one that's negative.
I think Carlyle's negative.
Carlyle Group is up 17% year to date.
Okay, all right. Well, maybe I'm being overly bearish on Carlyle. Okay, it's a finger in the air time. I reckon Blackstone, why not? Blackstone negative.
Correct. So Blackstone, so Apollo's up 25%, KKR's up 21%, Carlyle 17%, Ares Capital 1.7%, Blackstone's down nearly 2% on the year.
I wonder why. I don't know. I haven't seen any kind of particularly negative pieces of news, but maybe someone will put it in the comments and tell me why Blackstone...
The only thing I could see, which probably like triggers it in your mind from the technical reasons as why, but the revenue that I read, they took a big hit last year, Blackstone, because they generate revenue from management and performance fees, and real estate investments in particular are their largest revenue driver.
Okay.
And real estate revenue halved in 2023 and only accounted for 35% of their revenue for last year. And that was down from around 55%.
Okay, so yeah, maybe overexposed to a cyclically downward trending sector. Interesting. Okay, good to know.
Just to round off the stats, in terms of the five-year performance, because I always think, okay, year-to-date, it's pretty under the microscope. Stepping back a little bit, the best performer in that period is KKR. They're up 324%. In the last 5 years. Blackstone are only up 250%. So lagging. Ares Capital are only up 16%. So yeah, KKR is winning the 5 year for sure.
Well, let's talk. Well, I mean, we're talking about the present now. Let's talk about why. And it's really interesting that they are number one in terms of 5 year performance. They have been fantastic, performing extremely well over the last few years. Their their management fee income has more than doubled in the last 3 years. Their assets under management has almost doubled, well, over doubled actually in the last 3 years. So they're kind of firing on all cylinders. And they've got three different segments. And I really like this about the business and possibly why they're outperforming the likes of Blackstone that might be a little bit more concentrated. They've got their kind of core private equity asset management division. So that's private equity, infrastructure, real estate, and credit, all of which are very healthy and growing year on year. They have the insurance division. So they acquired a company called Global Atlantic in 2021, and actually very, very recently bought the remaining 37% that they didn't own. That was in January or maybe December of last year. So this is basically an assets under management play. Insurance firms, and so Global Atlantic is an annuity, retirement and life insurance company, added $90 billion of assets under management to KKR, but has almost doubled that assets under management in the last 3 years. So it's got about 160 billion of assets that KKR are now managing and making revenue and generating revenue from it. So you've got your insurance, you've got your core private equity, you've got your insurance, which is a different business, but has some complementarity. And then it has, this is super interesting, it has strategic holdings. So this is KKR's direct investment arm. So remember, private equity firms invest money on behalf of institutional investors, like private equity, so pension funds and things like that. Whereas KKR, they invest the company's money in direct investments alongside some of their fund investments. So Strategic Holdings is the name of the divisions, but this is kind of, I think they also call it core private equity. It's a bit like the Berkshire Hathaway model. This is the way that I like to think about it. They actually own on their own balance sheet, not just on behalf of investors. They actually own big slices in hundreds of these companies. And that division is growing and growing and growing. And what KKR has done so well, that Blackstone hasn't, by the way, is reinvested its profits instead of distributing them as dividends. So they make a nice, healthy profit every year, both in terms of the management fee and the carry, classic 2 and 20 model, 2% management fee, 20% of the upside from the fund's return over a certain hurdle rate. They reinvest that back into the strategic holdings, the direct investments of the business. So it gives them this wonderful diversification where they've got the fund management business, they've got the insurance business, and then they've got direct investments, which I think is probably a reason why their stock's doing so well.
And so is that explanation then also what we're going to expect that's going to take them to a trillion in 5 years?
Yeah, a trillion in 5 years. It sounds like a big number, but I don't think that's particularly ambitious, to be honest. I know that sounds ridiculous. That's adding another $450 billion of assets under management to get them to a trillion. But look, there's precedent with Blackstone. What I liked about, and again, definitely check out their investor presentation because it's quality. You don't need to go more than 60 or 70 slides into it. I can guarantee you that. I love this phrase. We are going to compete in large addressable markets where KKR can be a top three player. For anyone looking to start a business or start a new business unit, that is brilliant advice. Large addressable markets where KKR can be a top three player. So asset management, it says multiple paths to surpass $1 trillion in the next 5 years. Insurance, strong conviction we can double Global Atlantic's AUM again. And then Strategic Holdings, 1 billion plus of annual operating earnings feeding back into the company every single year. This is how they're going to do it. Number one, Asia. Asia as a driver of growth. KKR is probably the leading private equity franchise in Asia and Japan. In fact, it's more than tripled its AUM in Japan from 2018 to 2023 and is expected to drive 60% of global growth. So again, note to students, you always follow where the strategic priority of that firm is. And if you're thinking a bit of KKR and you're based in Asia Pacific, well, that's a pretty nice, that's better than thinking about Carlyle, who are pulling away from Asia Pacific. Number two, infrastructure. We mentioned both Asia and infrastructure in the kind of corporate history of the company. Infrastructure is a massive growth area. In fact, their assets under management for infrastructure investments went from $13 billion in 2018 to $59 billion in 2023. And I love it when these presentations give big numbers. And these are all big numbers. But there's a $100 trillion total global infrastructure need by 2040. So there you go. $7 trillion annual investment required. So yeah, big markets, big addressable markets where KKR could be a top three.
Who's fact-checking this PowerPoint when they come out with numbers like that?
Look, unfortunately, my screenshots of this slide don't give me the note. I'm sure the note is, you know, internal research conducted by KKR in there's probably McKinsey in there.
I know where it was done.
McKinsey would do something, wouldn't it?
It was done at Tom and Rosie's back a napkin after a steak dinner.
it's fantastic. I mean, I used to run a company and when we were raising money, you would almost try to outcompete other startups by saying we're in a $200 trillion market, and if we can capture just 1% of that $200 trillion market, we'll be massive. And it's all kind of numbers plucked out of a Gartner report or basically a Statista or something out of thin air that makes you feel like you're in a big market. But I do agree that the global infrastructure need is massive. Whether it's $100 trillion or not, I'm not entirely sure. Number
that,
three.
On that infrastructure point, I know we talked a lot about Saudi Arabia before. So would they have pretty tight relations in those sort of geographic areas as well?
Yeah, I'm sure they do. I don't know what their presence is actually in the Middle East, but I think that there is a general, there's a load of really interesting reports about the divergence between stock markets and stock market performance and the replenishment rate of core infrastructure across the world, and in particular in the West. And it's actually one of the factors that makes people in the US and people in the UK think that the economy is going badly and think that life is getting worse. Because although we might be getting paid more, although our investments are going through the roof and US economy is growing, if you're getting a rickety train or your road's closed or there are potholes or your broadband's down and you don't have signal, you feel poorer. So there is this massive...
Stephen, I thought it was only me. That's it. You should run for PM. I think Stephen for PM.
They don't pay enough. get me a job at KKR. there is this massive replenishment need, and the gap is pretty stark. So again, Middle East for sure, but globally it's huge. All right, number three, individuals managing their own wealth. So, and again, this is definitely a US focused slide, but again, previously you would get an intermediary to manage your wealth, and that private equity firm would be able to reach out to the intermediary and kind of tout its benefits to the intermediary, and that would be the way that it worked. But increasingly, retail investors are A, wanting to take charge of their own wealth, and B, getting access to the world of private equity. There are platforms like Moonfair now that you can actually get a slice of a private equity fund for as little as 50,000 euros. Which actually, in the scheme of wealth management and investing, is not very much. So they're kind of focusing on KKR actually being more of a public brand, more of a retail-focused brand. So you might actually see a little bit more of KKR out and about, as it were. All right, number four, credit. Massive, massive push on credit. So again, this is a $40 trillion problem, or $40 trillion market. They're leveraged credit, so providing debt for leveraged buyouts, has tripled in the last 3 years. They're going to be focusing more on real estate financing and asset-backed financing. I don't know if you saw this slide, but these credit slides just make me think these guys are just being a bank, right? So asset-backed financing, real estate financing, third-party insurance financing related to that, direct lending, leveraged credit. It's all the stuff that banks do. So they're stepping in to fill the void of banks that are so hamstrung and so safe. And it's a really interesting tactic.
I was just thinking of the, obviously we're talking different economies of scale to some degree, but I was looking at the number of employees at these places. And as you said, they're moving into the territory of more traditional big full service banks, but they only have like 2,500 employees, most of these companies we're talking about here. Whereas a JP Morgan has what, 45,000 in just their technology department. So yeah. I mean, kind of like pound per person. I mean, these companies must be like, I'm talking like, how do you, to get into one of these companies as an employee, you've got to be, is it like these are the, this is where you're gunning for to head mid-career to become senior at? Is that the general path?
Yeah, I think there's still the path that you do your kind of first few years at a bulge bracket bank that has hundreds of thousands of employees, and it has the infrastructure to bring you through from spring week to internship to graduate program to training to mentorship to line management and all of these kind of things. And then maybe you jump out into a private equity firm that, I mean, KKR is no longer freewheeling. It's a proper massive institution that's going to have a lot of structure and things like that, but it's certainly going to be less bureaucratic than a major bank. So yeah, I mean, again, revenue per person is definitely going to be higher in a KKR than it is in a bulge bracket bank. But bulge bracket bank, you are a full service bank. You're dealing with you know, small company, business to business lending, business banking, you're dealing with retail banking. KKR is just picking off the bits that have a massive addressable market where it can be in the top three.
Makes sense.
And the last one, just to wrap this up, this is why they're going to get to $1 trillion. The last one is it's a growing market. Private equity is expected to have a 12% compound annual growth rate in terms of assets under management between 2018 and 2028 to reach $24 trillion by 2028. So if KKR reaches its $1 trillion goal, it's still only taking a relatively small fraction of the total private equity alternative assets under management. So there's a lot of space to move into, I think it's fair to say. And the private equity juggernaut doesn't seem to be going anywhere. We've spoken about it a lot on the pod over the last few weeks.
Okay, so what I'll do is I'm going to put a poll on the Spotify episode, and I'm going to put then the five-year target was $1 trillion. And I'm going to put some numbers in excess of that and some numbers below that. And let's see what people feel. Are they going to hit the mark? Are they going to exceed it or not even get close to it?
Well, I'm pretty bullish, not to influence the poll. I'm pretty bullish. And I'm always a fan of companies that have still got their kind of founders at the heart of the companies. And two of the three are still knocking around. Bearing in mind, they set this company up in 1976, and Kravis and Roberts are still there as executive chairman or something like that. So there is good longevity in this business, and I think it's paid dividends over the course of the last, going on for 50 years.
And what, these guys are early 80s, so if Buffett is any guide, they've still got another two decades ahead of them.
They got another 20 years in them, yeah. And you've got, you know, they're not, and they're probably not going to be short of a few bob as well.
Nice. All right, Stephen, thank you for that insight. Fascinating as ever. And yeah, see you next week.
Thank you very much, Ant.
If you did enjoy that episode, remember to drop us a rating, or even better still, leave us a review, and it will really help get the podcast out to as many people as possible. Thank you.